Hi guys, welcome back to the Assist Podcast. I'm excited today for our first guest, someone who has a long history in football, many roles. But my personal experience, I've had a 5-minute verbal tirade on the phone with this man. I've had an arm around the shoulder when days haven't been gone so well in football. We have delivered my first child together, which was an amazing experience. And a man just full of knowledge, full of love, and has been a great person that I've had in my life who's helped me through some dark times and some great times. Barry Fry, how are you doing?
That needs no introduction.
Well, first and foremost, lads, Jim, Craig, I've got to say how brave you are. I watched that podcast that you put out at first. I fell off my chair. It was so honest, it was so refreshing, and it needed to be told because, believe it or not, I left school and I've been in football for 65 years ever since, and you know, I haven't worked a day in my life because I've been in something that I enjoy so much. Yeah. But I think there's so many people, the governing bodies in particular, sweeping it under the table, this big crisis we've got with mental health, with players of all ages. And you brought it out. And Craig, you know, I've known you for God knows how long now, and I didn't know you thought about taking your own life. That was, you know, I recommended you for Scotland. I went to Arsenal and watched your debut for Scotland against Brazil. I went to Spain and watched your game out there and things like that. And I've watched your career since you left us and went to Brighton. And unfortunately, if you hadn't have got the injury you got, you'd have had a better career. But I didn't know until I heard that podcast that you was going through hell and didn't really want to. I knew you beat yourself up.
Yeah.
Because at Peterborough, you could score 3 goals, we could win 3-2, and you was the man of the match. And, you know, you beat yourself up because you missed a couple of goals.
Yeah.
But when I had Jimmy Greaves at Barnet, Jim, how did you miss that? I'll be there next time, Gaffer. And he was. And it's like you was there. You was there.
Yeah.
Law of averages. If you keep getting the chances, you'll score some. But I first see you play at Olsey.
Yeah,
you come on a sub for 20 minutes. And he was unbelievable. He was so quick, so fast. He couldn't grab a bag of cement.
I think that was the whole of my career, though. Yes.
He made such an impact. I was at Barnet at the time, and I tried to get him. One of my old players was manager at the time. But John Still, who's a great judge of a player, took him to Dagenham, and we watched him ever since. And we signed him and loaned him back. And then before he was supposed to come back, I had a phone call from Barry Earn, the chairman of Leighton Orient. And he said, Barry, you've got a player that you've signed, but you haven't had him yet. And my manager wants him. And he's talked to the player and his agents, and he want to come to us. So I said, Barry, do you want 15 rounds? He said, yeah, I'll knock you out. I said, look, he's signed for us. We've paid the deposit. We've loaned him back. He's due to come back whenever, blah, blah, blah. I ain't letting it go. So he said, Baz, I respect you for in the game. I won't touch it. But I had very big problems. Keith Alexander, to be fair, my chairman, Darren McAntony, when he first bought the club off me, He gave me 3 players. He said, do you know who the white Pelly is? I went, of course I do. George Boyd at Stevenage. What are you on about? So he said, do you know him? I went, yeah. Better still, I know Ray Aggio, who George works in his shop part-time, a newsagent. So he said, oh, find out what it is to get him away. He had a release clause, 250 grand, which we paid. Aaron McLean, yeah, of course I know. Grace, blah, 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 done. Yeah, so we got him. And do you know Craig McHale Smith? I said, yeah, of course, I've seen him when he was at Olsey. Yeah, I know all about him. So it was him that put them to us. At the time, I had Keith Alexander as my manager because I didn't have a pot to piss in. So I knew I wanted somebody that could get me non-league gems for nothing. And Keith was the best man for that job. So we said to Keith, obviously, because it's no good buying players if the manager don't want them. He said all day long, but we won't be able to afford them. But Darren McAntony said, yes, we will. So Darren played all the money and he got them. But his knowledge, Darren McAntony, of non-league players and league players was second to none when I met him. And he was only 29 when he bought the club off me. Mm-hmm. Amazing. But unfortunately, then we had a January window and we was up there and he said to Keith, who do you want to sign? And Keith said, nobody, I'm happy with the squad. Well, that was fatal because we went the whole of January and never won a game. So, of course, Dara said, I've got to sack him. So I sacked him, of course, because he was my man. And then he said, where do we go from here? And I said, well, I've always fancied Darren Ferguson as player manager. He'd be the best player in League Two and he'd be a great manager because he's done a lot at Wrexham and all that, coaching. Doing this, doing that. So we had a conversation with him and we got him in the end. But, you know, so then Darren spoke to Craig and Darren come back to me and said, he don't want to come. We've lost him. I went, never in a million years have we lost him. So I fought very hard to get Craig. I had to convince. I even went round his house when he weren't there, see his mum and dad. Yeah, and his dad wouldn't let me in it first.
How old would you have been here?
23.
Yeah, so I just turning 23. Yeah. But I just knew he was a great player for us, and he would have been, and he was. I mean, the three boys that I mentioned, that the Holy Trinity, they're arguably three of the best players that Peterborough United have ever bought. Wow. And their contribution to our success was enormous, each one of them. Wow. And they're great mates now, you know. And so it was hard to get Craig, and I don't think he, thought too much of him because I had a lot of foul and abusive language.
I was training in the park while I wasn't.
And then I was the last to know when him and Amber went out because they was both frightened to tell me. So we go back a long way, but it's all turned out great. Mm. It's fantastic.
Good. Barry, you're renowned in football for being a great storyteller, a great football man, and you have this incredible knowledge of players of all levels, right down through the non-league pyramid all the way up to the Premier League. And I think it's interesting for us to start kind of at the beginning. I don't want this to be a podcast where we kind of replicate what you've done before, because we're going to have a different conversation. But I think it's still nice to start at the beginning and then let you kind of fill us in a little bit from there. So I was talking to your lovely daughter, Amber, yesterday. And she was explaining to me because a lot of when we talk about the mental side of things, things stem from childhood, things stem from what we experience in our younger years. So she described you as a bit of a naughty kid, loved his football, loved his cricket, didn't want to listen to the teachers at school until they told you that there would be no football. And at that point, you started paying a bit more attention. You go on to be a very, very talented young football player, playing for England schoolboys, scoring in front of 90,000 at Wembley. 95,000 at Wembley against Scotland. And scoring, as we just said, five times in six games, which is incredible at schoolboy level. You then later signed for Man United the year before the Busby Babes. And during that time, become quite good friends with George Best. He felt a little bit indebted to you over the time because you would often buy his tickets so he could send money home to his family back in Ireland and things like that. And you developed this relationship there. Sadly, your career then ends with an injury, too early, really. And that would probably shape a lot of young players. That would kind of be the end of the road for a lot of people. And in your case, it perhaps was the start of something new. So at that point, as a young man, when you kind of experience this glory, scoring in front of 95,000, which is incomparable, you're playing for Manchester United, surrounded by like the likes of the Busby Babes and George Best and people like that, and you get this injury, and football as you know it changes. where do you go from there? How do you become, I know it's going to be a longer answer, how do you become the man today who is so well respected in football without playing too much at that point?
Yeah, the, you know, you could say I had two careers, one as a player, one as a manager. As a player, I started at the very top, playing for England 6 times, scoring 5 goals. You know, in the victory we had over Scotland at Wembley in front of 95,000, and playing in our team was Len Badger, who was the golden boy at Sheffield United, Ronnie Harris, who was the golden boy at Chelsea, David Pleat. Playing for Scotland was Bobby Moncur, who lifted the last trophy that Newcastle ever had, George Graham. All them players went on to become great players, great managers. I went on to become a has-been that never was. I went to United. I was at United for 5 years, 2 years as an apprentice, 2 years as a pro.
Yeah.
I enjoyed every minute of it. Busby, Law, Charlton. Wow. Great, great players to have 3 or 4 years with. You know, no wonder I couldn't get in a team.
Yeah.
But I loved United. I loved the way they looked after us and things like that. But we played in Switzerland in 2 tournaments that we won both years. And I scored the winning goal with a diving header against Juventus. Kicked in my mouth, smashed all my teeth. That night, I had all blood all over my pillow and all that. And then since then, I had problems. I went to different clubs and I got injured, you know, knee in the thigh, dead leg. We've all had it. They just disappear, bruised, disappears. Mine clotted. And I had a hematoma, which is a blood clot. And I had to cut it out, and he was on crutches for 4 months, which is very lonely when you're not playing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came back, and then the same thing happened on the leg, the other leg. I was advised by 2 doctors to pack up because I had problems with my blood. Instead of bruising and dispersing, it clotted. And if that clot travelled to your heart, you're dead.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, at 20-odd, you don't want to be told that because you feel fit as anything. Later on in life, I did have 2 heart attacks. I have had 2 kneecap operations. I've had 2 hip operations. My dicks fell off. Apart from that, I'm fit as a fiddle.
And you are looking fit as a fiddle at 79 and a bit.
Yeah.
Which is amazing. But so back then, experiencing something like that, I don't imagine it would have been, I mean, I imagine it was a lonely place, but to actually vocalise the fact that you were feeling lonely or feeling low, was that ever something you would have done in that day and age?
Yeah, I think, you know, I left school, right, and went straight to Manchester.
Mm.
Believe it or not, I'd never had a holiday in my life.
Mm.
So I'd never been out of Bedford. So it was a big thing for me to go in the digs. And funnily enough, I moved into the digs. I moved into the digs at Sale, which is outside Manchester. And then Bobby Charlton got married and he moved out to the digs and I moved into his bed because that was in Stretford, just round the corner from Old Trafford.
Yeah.
So it was ideal. But it was wonderful being there, but when you're injured and everything, you're not part of it.
No. Mm.
You're not part of it at all.
Yeah.
It's lonely.
Yeah.
And you get into bad habits like gambling.
Yeah.
I went to the dogs 5 nights a week.
Really?
You know, Tuesday and Friday, Salford, Monday and Wednesday, White City. You get into gambling. And I'd never gambled until I went there, but you're on your own. You're with the mates, they like a bet, you go with them
just to go out,
just to do something.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I was addicted to gambling then. I liked the horses, I liked the dogs. In fact, in part-time, because we used to train in the morning, that was it, I used to work at Gus Demme's, a betting office, round the corner from Old Trafford.
Wow.
And chalking the prices up. So it really, although I loved it, it gets hold of you and you know, you finish up gambling and doing whatever you got and things like that, and then you're chasing your money, bad habits. But this is what happens with players. They've got too much free time on their hands, you know, and you either turn to drink, you turn to drugs, turn to gambling, and it takes the focus off what you really want to be as a top professional footballer.
It's really interesting to hear that, because we're still seeing these problems now. We're still seeing the exact same things. How many years on was this? How long are we talking about? How old were you at this point?
It's 1960 I joined Man United. Wow. When I left school. You know, I had 4 years there. Talking about Best, Matt Busby called me in one day. He says, Barry, you're a flash cockney bastard. I said, thank you very much, boss. He said, I've got two shy Belfast boys coming over, Eric McMordy and George Best, and I want you to look after George Best. I went, no problem, boss. I'd done such a good job with Bestie that after 2 days he ran back home to Belfast. But he didn't hold it against me. And later on in life, I asked him to guest for me in my first club, Dunstable, and he come and played. And he's been a real friend to me, and done unbelievable things. He's guested for me 6 times, turned up every time. Wow. And This Is Your Life he was on, and I was on and all that. And we're in the green room, and, you know, there's Michael Parkinson, there's Pat Jennings, who he roomed with, there's David Sadler, who he roomed with at United. There's 15 Miss Worlds, you know what I mean? And I'm saying, Bestie, what the hell made you come and play for me at Dunstable? Yeah. And he said, Baz, I'll never forget you. He said, you bought my comps off me. I used to go with a girl, and her father was a big Man United fan. So all the lads, all the apprentices, we used to play on Saturday. So the comps we got, we didn't really use. So he bought them all off me, and I shared all the money out with the lads. And I didn't know until This Is Your Life thing, Bestie said to me, you gave me the money. I only had that money. I used to send all my wages back home to my mum and dad. Wow. But what a great man. Yeah. This man was world class.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, he was more famous than the Beatles.
Yeah.
You know, he was unbelievable. But that little thing meant so much to him at that time.
Yeah, wow.
So when people ring me up and say, have you got a story about Bestie? I can give you 100 good ones, but you never read about them.
No,
they all want to know, but they can, front page, back page, all the middle pages, you hear bad. This guy done so much for me, I wouldn't be sat with you now if it weren't for him. You know, just because I looked after him when he didn't have anything. But sometimes you go as high as you can, like George did, you forget the small fries, don't you? Not Bestie.
No.
It's amazing.
I think something you touched upon there, which is really interesting, is that front page, back page, middle page. So obviously in today's game, we have social media and people have access to people's lives all the time. But even back then it was newspapers. And I know you dealt with some stuff yourself throughout your career with newspapers and things like that, where people's mental health or mental state isn't taken into consideration at any point.
At all. No. The media's got a great way of lifting you up and then chopping you in half.
Yeah.
But I think the mental health thing has been going on ever since I've been in the game, 65 years, and not enough. The governing bodies don't do enough to help it. They just sweep it under the table, which is no good to anybody. Yeah. Because this happens at academy level. You know, I've been at Peterborough for 30 years, right? And we have kids with us at 8, all the way up till they sign an apprenticeship, then they're due, that finishes, they want a pro contract. And you've got to sit with them. I was manager for 10 years. I used to sit with them and say, don't think you're going to make it, son. We ain't offering you another contract. Tears. Mums and dads come and see you. You know, ever since he's been 8, you know, he's wanted to be a professional footballer. You're telling him he can't be. I said, well, no, but go out there. That's my opinion. Go out there and prove me wrong. You know, David Platt, Stan Collymore, all these, I give them people that's got bombed out by professional clubs but have come back and they're top of the tree. You know, go and prove us wrong and all that. But the effect that has, it kills you because that's all these kids wanted all their life. Mm. For 10 years they've been with you. You know, they had dreamt of being a professional footballer, playing in the first team and things like that, and it's not happened. It affects them. It affects their mum and dad. It affects their whole family. People don't realise. And if they don't get another club, they lock themselves in their room. They don't come out. They've got nothing to live for. And I have to go round their house and say, come on, there's more to life than this. You know, go part-time. You could do this, do that. Very, very difficult. So I've seen it for so many years, the mental health, even at top level. You know, if you're not in the team, you got time on your hands. You go gambling. You go. It's a terrible thing. You're addicted to gambling. You're addicted to drugs. You're addicted to drink. It happens all the time, all the time, all the time. And people that's made a fortune out of the game finish up potless. Because they don't get the right advice. They don't get the right help. Nobody listens to you. It's awful. That's why I think what you guys are doing is absolutely fantastic.
Thank you.
I think people should take notice of what you're doing. It will help. You will save lives. I'm telling you, you will save lives.
I hope so. Yeah.
Because people like me and the ordinary people out there in this don't realise how it affects people mentally, physically, how depressing it gets, how suicidal it gets. Mm-hmm. You know, I've put people to the sporting chance to the clinic because I used to play with Gordon Taylor at Bolton and he was in charge of the PFA. I used to ring him up, this guy needs help, Gordon. Can you get him into the clinic, Tony Adams and all that? And Gordon's helped me no end of times by getting people into the clinic, by helping them, you know, but they're only there 4 or 5 weeks and all that, and then they've tried to do it, but it's hard. They keep going back, some of them. And it's an awful, awful thing in football and in society. We must do more to stop people being suicidal. We must help them in any way we can. That's why you two are doing a fantastic job. And people, the main thing is these people go and hide themselves in the bedroom. They can't come out. They don't want to see anybody. They're not comfortable to talk to you. They're not comfortable to eat with you. They're not comfortable to socialise. They need to talk. They need to bring things out. They need to talk to somebody. They need to be given a bit of hope that it's no good ending your life. There's a plenty in front of you, you know, but they do need help.
They do.
With regards to the academy system, which you're talking about, what more can be done? Because obviously, as you said, they're so focused on being professional footballers and all their time is being focused on that. What more can be done to like give them a balance so they know that they're trying to become a professional footballer? There is more to life outside of that. What more can clubs do?
Well, what we do at our club now with the academy, we've gone to Category 2 and we're trying to improve things because we know what's happened to some of our players that we've released and things like that. And and we get special people that talk to them. But the main object is they have to go to school. We're in a partnership with a school right next to our training ground, right?
Yeah.
They have to go to school. They have to get the qualifications.
Yeah.
They have to, for the simple reason that if football's a no, they've got something to fall back on.
Yeah.
And that is, and we explained to mum and dad, you know, they must go to school because half the kids don't want to go to school.
Yeah.
You
know, and I used to say, I've got 3 boys, you know, none of them's made it through whatever reason and what have you. But I used to say, it don't matter about education, they're going to be footballers. Yeah. But they ain't. Mm. You know what I mean? They get injured, they get this, they get that, they're not good enough or whatever. So they need something else. And my wife, kills me every time because I didn't tell them, you've got to have an education because there's so many people, there's brilliant players not picked up anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, so I've learned that and I've brought it into the club and we are religiously bosh.
Good.
You know, we've got to have an education. We explained to the parents and all, they've got to have something. It still disappoints them, but at least they've got their qualifications to do something and they've been at school and they've played. We often have the school moan about Tom, Dick or Harry because their minds are in class, but their minds are elsewhere on football. Mm. So we have to have them boys and the mum and dads in and say, look, the school's come to us. You know, they're not happy because he's not concentrating on his schoolwork. Yeah. That's no good to us and it's no good to you. So he's got to concentrate more. Mm. While he's in school, he's got to concentrate on that. Then he comes to us to train and what have you, let him enjoy himself playing football.
Yeah.
But it's a balance in
that. I think that filters up into the first team though. I think it's so driven within the first team to just think football, you know, not really kind of want you to concentrate on anything outside of football.
Mm.
I think then probably needs to be more done at that level as well, where football, you can only concentrate on football for such an amount of period of time you're in the building. And there should be that encouragement to then actually focus on something outside of football.
Yeah, yeah.
That gives them a base. Because I know for me, when I was playing, I didn't really concentrate on getting, I got education kind of leading into football, but then when I was playing my career, there was never that thing of like, do more stuff, do courses. Like I was always thinking football's there, it's always going to be there, I'm always going to get contracts. And it was never kind of put upon me to go and do stuff outside. It was just like, just concentrate on your football, just keep doing that. And then when you get to the end, I got to the end, I was like, wow, I've got nothing to and that's
yeah,
why.
But Craig, that's your own fault. I told you time and again, go into coaching, go into management, get your qualifications.
I know.
You told me to F off.
But I think in that time when I spoke to
you, just wanted to concentrate on your football. I understand that.
But also, I think I had like crisis of confidence in that period of time.
I didn't realise that.
So that was like, I didn't feel comfortable enough to step out. I knew football to the best of my ability, but I didn't have that confidence to step out of that my comfort zone and go and study other stuff. And I think there's probably lots of other players who are like that. So it's, I think when you're still in the game, if you've got those, I didn't feel there was much there for me to kind of be looked after to go and do that. I know the PFA do a little bit, but it was just, I never felt like I was encouraged or it was a good thing to do. So I just stayed and focused on my football. And they say probably buried my head in the sand a little bit rather than kind of saying, right, football's going to come to end. I need to do this. But obviously, that's just, kind of going back to the point I was making, it's like that needs to kind of be filtered from the academies and also filtered from the first team. Mm. So the young players see that there are players going above and beyond just the football aspect. They're actually going on and actually doing courses, doing stuff to make them better beyond football. Mm. I think it needs to be highlighted what people are doing. So then they don't just go, oh, they're a pro. They're just concentrating on football. It's good if you see a pro's going, oh, he's concentrating football, but he's also got this in the background. Mm. And I think as a kid, you're then more likely to then focus on two things rather than one.
Yeah, yeah. Jim, I remember being at Wembley. I go to Wembley for everything, internationals, playoffs, vice final, trophy final, everything. I love Wembley. But I remember listening to your podcast and I was at Wembley when Newport Pagnell won, deservedly so, brilliant performance. And then when I heard your podcast and you was all over the place and don't remember it, how sad that is because of the state of mind you was. You know, Wembley, ever since I was a toddler, Wembley was my goal, you know. And
It was mine as well, Barry. Yeah,
but to not remember it is heartbreaking, really. But it shows you the pain and what you was going through, the mental state.
But let it also show hope, Barry, because I may not remember that day, but it's everything that has followed that. Mm. As much as there were some fucking low points in that journey, I'm sat here today with you having this conversation. And I've never felt more in the right place. I've never felt happier in my skin than being in this moment with you guys in here,
Jim,
having these conversations.
That should encourage everybody that listens to this, everybody that's struggling with mental health. The fact that you two's come out and said it, and we've all had problems.
Mm. Yeah,
we just don't speak about it.
Yeah.
And that's the problem. You need to communicate with people.
Mm.
And that's why I say the governing bodies, for me, don't do enough. They don't put themselves out enough. No. It's the PFA's members.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's the league players. You know, there wouldn't be a league without players. We've got to look after them more because it's not all Premier League getting 300 grand a week or a day or whatever it is. You know, lower down, that's nowhere near. Everybody thinks footballers are millionaires. They're not.
No.
At our level and all that, what they get paid is not very good, plenty of incentives and all that. That's what gives you the incentive to get on and be a player and go to the top, because you've only got to get one move. And we've sold 19 players that moved from us and became millionaires overnight with the 4 or 5 year contracts they got and the wage increase.
I'm just going to go back a little bit, and I'm going to touch upon something you said. I'm going to ask Craig a question now. And I don't think I've ever asked you this.
Okay.
It is interesting. So, Barry, you talked about you were encouraging Craig to go into coaching after football. Did you love football?
Yeah, I loved it and I hated it.
Because
it's a weird thing, isn't it?
Yeah, I have never asked you that question.
Yeah.
And I've got no interest in being a coach or a manager. I've loved playing football. I don't even really, as I mentioned to you on the way here, I kind of support Kettering Town, but I don't actually really support a football team.
No.
I'm open to offers. But I don't really support a football. And I wouldn't actually say I love football. There's elements of it. Yeah. I like being part of a team. I like physical activity. I like the feeling of scoring a goal. Growing up, how it made me feel in terms of going to a new school, I could always make friends being good at football, or I always liked people thinking I was good at football. Essentially, it made me cool, if you will. But I don't think I've ever asked you, when you're talking about, did you have any desire to go into coaching after football? Did you want to be in football forever? Did you love football?
I mean, I love football. It was like a love-hate relationship. I loved it and I loved being involved in it. But then when I was playing it, then I'd lose love of it because it just wasn't going how I wanted it to go.
Yeah.
It's weird. And then you'd come out of it and obviously you came out through injuries and stuff like that. And then I'd miss it and I'd love it again.
Yeah.
And then I'd go back into it and I'd try and then it'd go wrong again and then I'd hate it again. And then it was just a vicious cycle
Craig, the problem is you've got a lot to offer other players.
Mm.
From a coach, from, you've got a lot to offer. There's a lot of clubs out there that haven't got striker coaches, and yet it's the most important position in the field, scoring goals.
He's amazing at it. He is amazing.
But you haven't been interested. Now I think you are interested. I think you've got a lot to offer, and you've got to get in there. I know you're in the game now at Woking and doing well. Well done. But you've got a lot to offer.
I think, again, as I was playing, it was just focused on me, focus on what I'm doing, play the game. Instead, it was love hate. It's like I'd go really well and I'd go on goals and feel great, and then you'd have bad performances and I'd be really low and I'd hate it, and then I'd get injured and I'd then enjoy the fact that I was out of it. Then I'd want to be back in it. So it was like a tumultuous up and down, emotional roller coaster. And then with regards to coaching and that, I never really crossed my mind. And because I was really unconfident in myself. Yeah. I didn't have self-belief, self-worth, and I didn't feel like I could stand up in front of 15, 20 people and say you need to be here, because I'd always be judging myself of is that the right thing to say? Am I doing the right thing? So that would always kind of worry me. And then as I came out of the game and obviously went through all my ups and downs and kind of finding myself a bit more and finding my self-worth, then I started to realise I have got more to offer. I feel comfortable standing in front of people and talking. But in that period when I was playing, I never really felt I did. Mm. I think that's why I stayed away from doing education. I think that's why I stayed away from doing other stuff, because it's just I felt I've just put myself in a position where I feel like I was exposing myself.
Well, every game I ever see you play, whether it's for us or Aylesbury or Aussie rather, Dagenham, you give 150%.
Yeah.
And you scored amazing goals. Talk about scoring, I've got to tell you. When I went to Bolton, we played at Cardiff, Nenyon Park.
Yeah.
And we had a good side at Bolton then. We had Eddie Hopkinson, the England goalie. He rolled the ball out to Roy Hartle, our right back, who hit it straight at me like a cannonball. Thank God Freddie Hill shouted, "Leave it." He pulled it down, played a 1-2 and hit this ball out to our outside left. Little Gordon Taylor caught it on his chest, trapped it on the side. Right, right winger come to him, he beat him. The right half come to him, he beat him. The right back come to him, he beat him. The big centre half left the middle, tried to chop him in half. He's pushed the ball, hurdled his legs. He's run from the halfway line to the byline and hit this great ball over. Playing for us was 6'5" Wyn Davis. He's jumped 8'5". Playing for Cardiff was the great, the late John Charles, gentle giant. He could play centre-half or centre-forward. He was playing centre-half this particular game to combat Wyn Davis's aerial ability. He's jumped 8'6". They both missed it, hit me on the head and went in. Goal! Goal! I only tell you that, it was my first league goal. As it happened, it was my last.
I asked that question to you a minute ago, Craig. It's a great story. And this is interesting, and I'll tell you off air who told me this. He was playing the day you ruptured your Achilles.
Yep.
For Peterborough. And told me recently, he hated football. Always hated football. And he had a figure in his mind he wanted to make from football. Yep. And he was out.
Yeah.
And he done it. Now, the reason I ask is because, yes, people are offered these coaching badges and pathways into coaching or management or different things as well. But I think one of the things me and you have bonded over is the fact that we're not the stereotypical football player. We're not the stereotypical male involved in football. Mm. So I think it's hard for some young men to see an avenue an option out after football when it's not something that necessarily stimulates you in the way that maybe the game does. So yeah. Education is great. And what you're doing at Peterborough is fantastic. And obviously encouraging players to get into coaching, get into their badges and go follow that route is fantastic for so many people. But more and more so now we're finding people like ourselves who football isn't the be all and end all for us.
No, Jim, the problem is in football now, it's changed over the years. And now, if you haven't got certain qualifications, you're not allowed to work for that football club.
Yeah.
That's why qualifications are so important now.
But I mean, even so, it's okay to finish football and to try something else.
Absolutely.
But I think as a footballer, you're in it and it's an easy thing because I don't feel there's enough options offered. Like when you're obviously playing, you're only concentrating football. Again, more than likely you go away from football, you're still thinking about football. So you're not actually looking at what's beyond the world, what your likes are. And there's, I think it's like life after professional sport. I've seen do a lot with players outside of football and athletes and guide them to different careers.
Yeah.
But I think when you're in football, you just think, I don't know what else to do, so I'm just going to be a coach.
Yeah.
And I think there's not enough to go, what's your likes? Like what, because obviously, you know, our likes are not the football-esque lights. No. Well, what do you like to do? Do you like to be a vet? What do you like to do? And then build a pathway outside of it. But I just think because there isn't, it's just an easy thing to go, I know football, I've been in it all my whole life. I'm a bit nervous to go beyond that. I'm just going to stay and be a coach.
And that for me is where we're getting this lack of identity, both in youth athletes and in players finishing the game, and sometimes in players still playing it. And I'm experiencing it through some of the players that I work with. Yeah. I'm sure you're experiencing it, and I know Craig is as well, whereby that when we go back to the academy conversation, when you let them go at 16, 17, 18, whatever, what is their identity? If I'm not a footballer, what am I? When Craig finished his career, if I'm not a footballer, what am I? Yeah. And this is for me is one of the hardest things. And this is going to take a real cultural shift whereby it is a fantastic role in life to be involved in football. Of course it is. It's a dream for so many.
Jim, you're so right. There's so many players finish their career and haven't got a clue what they're going to do.
No.
They're lost. Mm. And that's when boredom set in. That's why they get bad habits. They sit and watch racing every day and things like that, or they go out drinking every day, or they forget that they've got nothing to look forward to, and yet they've had a glittering career.
Yeah.
So many people, you read in the paper, how's he gone bankrupt? How's he gone bankrupt? He's earned millions and millions, but he's gambled, he's drunk, he's drugged. There's more and more people coming out. Mm.
Yeah.
But you've forgotten, aren't you, once you come out of the game?
I mean, you're talking about top players.
You've forgotten once you come out of the game, you're not, that you're saying like the governing bodies, the PFA, I've finished, 36 playing professional football. I haven't heard a thing from them.
No.
Like, and I get
they
it.
Forget
they're,
you.
They're there. They're there. They're there if you
they
go
take,
to them.
They take your subs.
Yeah, but you're there if you want. If you need to go to them, I think when you, as a player, you need someone to come to you. You need someone to ring you up and say
they're the richest organisation in the world. The BFA. They get unbelievable amounts of money, but yet they should have another department that looking after players when they're finished.
Yeah. When we spoke before about like how many players are out of contract, you obviously know the figures when you see like how many players are out of contract at the end of the season and how many don't actually come back into the game.
More and more and more especially with this financial fair play coming in now. Clubs can't afford to take them and
where do they go?
And it's all the way to, exactly right. There's not enough clubs for them.
Yeah.
There's not enough places for them.
Where do
there's not enough budgets that these other clubs have got to take them on.
But they fall off the radar. They just disappear. Like, and it's like, where do they go from there? What are they doing? Like,
well, exactly right. Publicity-wise, you're in the front page, the back page, the middle pages all your life because you're a top footballer, top footballer, top footballer. You have to finish, whether it's injury or age or whatever it is, or people won't give you another contract, you're left with nothing.
Yeah.
What do you do? What am I doing?
And the obvious path to follow is when you've been used to riches and adulation and cheering, where do you get that from? Gambling can give you money and give you that buzz. Drinking definitely gives you a buzz. Drugs definitely give you a buzz. I've experienced in some cases players ended up being involved in business, not legal business, to try and replicate the money that they were earning in football because they're so used to earning it.
There's a lot of players done that and finished up in jail.
Yeah.
You know, you know, I've signed players that's come out of jail and come straight to me. I've given them a chance and they've rewarded me because they've realised whatever put them back in jail, they've realised that, you know, they want to put it right when they come out.
Mm.
But there's others that the way they're going, they'll end up where they ended up in jail, you know what I mean? Because they're on a sticky road.
It is hard. I think like the emotional roller coaster you have as a footballer, you have the major highs of scoring and promotions and all these different things, and obviously the major lows of being in football. But when you come out into the real world, like the emotional roller coaster isn't the same.
No.
So obviously for me, like scoring a goal, there's nothing that can replicate scoring a goal in front of 20, 40, 50,000 people.
Got one and I know
how it feels. So for me, coming out into the real world now, it's like I have to temper that. I have to understand that what I'm doing will still give me joy and still give me a buzz, but it will never give me the buzz of what scoring a goal was. And I kind of likened it the other day to someone. I said, like, I'm a drug addict, which will never get my fix again. And I have to learn to deal with that because it's like, obviously for me being at the goal end, it's scoring a goal is at the buzz. But obviously players have their own kind of things that set them off within that.
But the thing, what you'll find, lads, I think you've helped an enormous amount of people out there that need help. I think you've saved a lot of lives. You won't realise, but you have, if people get into your podcast that you've done at the beginning. I really do. And I'm telling you, the self-satisfaction you two will get out of helping other people, money couldn't buy it.
I agree. I liken this to, and I've explained this to Craig for many times, I had such a feeling of not just worthlessness, less than that. I was convinced that my existence was a stain on the earth. I really, really believed that by even living and breathing, I was affecting others negatively. So I made it. I got into drinking drugs, but I also got into helping people. And I remember when I used to live in Sheffield, I would go and find, and this isn't me trying to get any kudos or anything like that, but I'd go and find homeless people to try and offer them something to eat because that small act of kindness gave me something.
Self-satisfaction.
I felt a little bit more worthwhile that day.
Absolutely.
And luckily I'm not in that place anymore and I'm not going searching for people on the streets to try and make myself feel better. But there's worse things you can do.
Mm.
And there is a level of selfishness in being selfless. Mm-hmm. And I think that's okay. I really do think that's okay. And like Barry says, I think that's an amazing comment about I'm a drug addict who will never get his fix again. Mm. I think that's so profound. Yeah. But if we can help others in this situation, I think we'll get something far more that isn't fleeting, that doesn't just come and go, a sense of contentment and a sense of peace and a sense of community and a sense of happiness and a sense of joy in creating this community of like-minded individuals that we can help in this situation, because it's going to happen.
Well, the biggest problem you've got with mental health is you don't realise how it affects the loved ones around you, your mum, your dad, your brother, your sister, your wife, your kids. It affects the whole caboodle.
Mm.
It really is a awful, awful, awful place to be in.
Barry, and answer this however you wish. Growing up in a different generation to us, have you had any experiences throughout your career, throughout your life, whereby you were feeling prolonged periods of low feeling? And what did you do in those situations, if so?
I've never, ever, ever felt like taking my own life. I've lost everything. I went bankrupt. I got divorced. I lost my house. I've lost everything. I've been there, been the rock bottom. Now what do? Do you stay rock bottom and feel sorry for yourself? No, you get up and fight and make it a different world, make it a different place. But you need people around you to do that.
Yeah.
Mm. And, you know, I'm lucky enough to have a rock at home in Kirstein.
Yeah.
She's put up with me for 46 years, a silly bugger. But thank God she has, because, you know, without her, I mean, I come home all worried about football because we've lost a game, and she'll say, put the telly on. Look what's happening in the real world to real people. Yeah. You know what I mean? And it makes you... She's been brilliant. She had faith in me when I didn't even believe in myself.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So you do need help as well.
Mm. Yeah.
And there's no doubt about that. But I've been rock bottom. I've done it all. I know how other people can get addicted, particularly to gambling.
Yeah.
Not so much to drink. I've never been a big drinker. And I've never took drugs in my life, because at an early age, when I was in Manchester, somebody I loved dear was in jail for stabbing somebody. I was the only one, he disowned. Mm. I was the only one that come to Manchester, Aylesbury prison, to see him.
Mm.
He was in a state. I wanted to do all I could for him. He didn't even know whether he stabbed a guy or not, because he was spaced out. And imagine being in prison for a crime you didn't even know you committed. Mm. But he's come out and made a good job of it. He's a successful businessman. So it just shows you, despite the hard times, you can recover and have the good times.
You made a good point when you said you couldn't do it yourself. And I think that's obviously with us meeting each other, we were going through our turmoils at that time. And I think obviously us bonding together, we allowed ourselves to guide each other through it. And obviously by doing this, is that's what we really want to do and really want to get across to people, is if you don't, you're not doing it on your own, like, and you can't do it on your own. I found that I thought I was tough and I could take it all and I could work it out, and it just put me in a deeper, darker hole. And as soon as I started kind of expressing that and getting out and talking to people and obviously expressing it here, I've started to feel better in myself and finding people that can actually resonate with you and help guide you. I think that's what we want to do, and I think that's what we're hoping people feel comfortable enough, maybe listen to this, that gives them that first step in allowing it. But it's obviously how do we make that more feasible within football? How do we make that seen as something that you should be doing? Because it's not always that mental health has always been on the back burner. It's always been that little bit in the corner. If someone's suffering, we'll do a little tiny bit and then we'll just carry on what we're doing. It needs to be seen as, right, what's their mental health like? How can we secure their mental health? Because ultimately that's going to then allow them to perform better, become a better person. And obviously for the club, it means they're going to get better performances.
Yeah. So I used to get a lot of newspapers ring me up and say, oh, You didn't make it at Man United because of Matt Busby and you're living away from home. You didn't look after you right. I went, look, what a load of rubbish. Matt Busby had nothing to do with it. He gave me all the encouragement I needed. Mm. You know, I was scoring. We was winning 8-0 in the Youth Cup. I was getting 5.
Mm.
We was winning 4-3. I was getting 3. He gave me a great compliment that he was going to be the North's Jimmy Greaves and all that. I scored a lot of goals. It wasn't Matt Busby's fault that I failed at Man United. It was mine, because I was more interested in reading the Sporting Life than I was training or anything. My fault. Looked in the mirror, Barry Fry, your fault. Yeah. I wouldn't have a word said about him. You know what I mean? But people want to make things. But being a failure as a player made me more determined to be a success as a manager. I went into management at 28.
That's the key. That's the key there.
You know, and I lasted in management 32 years. And I, like you, are amazed I lasted that long. It's only so far bullshit can take you. But in saying that, you know, it just made me stronger and more determined and all that. And I've had a wonderful time as manager. I've been sacked everywhere I get, but it makes you more determined. Like I say, I left school at 15. I haven't worked in 65 years since. Because I've been in the game in some capacity or the other, and I've loved every minute. The highs, the lows, the in-betweens, I've loved it.
I think listening to you speak there, and I think this might be like a nice point for you to kind of give advice to young players kind of get in the game and different things. How important is personality? Because I've been lucky enough to be in your house. I've seen pictures of you with Alex Ferguson. I've heard stories today of you with George Best. Everyone knows some of the Harry Redknapp stories, like some of the most famous men in football, and they would all consider you a good friend. So how important is personality in football? How important is it about being a good person, walking into a room and lighting a room up?
Well, basically, I'd just be myself. People either hate me or love me, you know, there ain't no bit in between, but you just got to be yourself and judged on that. And like you say, I've been very, very lucky throughout my life of being involved with Lord Best Charlton, you know, Harry Redknapp, Ron Atkinson, all the top, Arsene Wenger, all the top people I've had a great relationship with, and long may it continue.
Authenticity.
That's going to say
we recorded an episode last week on exactly that ability to be perhaps the permission just to be yourself. And I think both of us lacked that until this point. I don't think I was truly being who I wanted to be or who I was proud to be up until recently. And again, like yourself, I've got a really good network behind me now, and I know Craig does as well. And that support network helps champion you in becoming that version of yourself. But what can we do in football to allow people to flourish in that way? And this is one of my biggest gripes. We have stat vests. We invest a hell of a lot of money in that. We have every statistic. I'm seeing times G now. I know exactly how far our players run. I know exactly how many sprints they've done. I know their heart rate. I know absolutely everything. And I'm just getting fed that to me from a TV screen. Obviously, they've got analyst guys, data guys in football who have a hell of a lot more information. I know you'd have done this, but how many people know the name of their player's wife or their player's kids? How many people know where they're from, what they're up to? Fuck all. And I take that's the correct answer. And the biggest, and for me, the biggest performance enhancing attribute would be getting people to play with a smile on their face. We talk about flow state. You and I have talked about this plenty of times. And when you're in that flow state, like kind of that you were describing that phase of play when you scored before, it's no data gives you that. No kind of, it's a feeling, it's an emotion, it's a happiness, and you can't replicate that. So why are we not investing more, or why are we not doing more in putting smiles on people's faces and making them feel authentic, making them say it's okay to be yourself? Yeah. It doesn't matter how far you've run today, how many sprints you've done, that'll all come. Because also, this is the other thing. I think you put a ceiling on people's potential when you give them a figure to chase. And in a centre forwards environment, it's always that 20 goals. If you get 20 at Christmas, are we done? Or if we get to the end of the season, you scored 19, you got 20 assists and you won the league. Was it a shit year? No, it fucking wasn't.
No, right. Yeah.
So we have all of this data fed into us as our success metric, but not enough is being done in football to just give someone a hug.
I think an important thing as well is team spirit. And I think when Craig was at the club, our team spirit was second to none. Mm. You know, all the lads went out together, their families went out together. They was a real team. I think this year, no disrespect to the players that are in there now, it's the worst team spirit we've ever had, for the simple reason, 1, 2, 3, 4 of you wanted to go in the summer and don't want to be here. Mm. Other people are on loan and they're not committed to you. It's a mixed bag. Mm. And that's why we struggled. Apart from the injuries, we've had horrendous injuries you could not believe this season.
Yeah.
But it's a combination and we're really, really struggling and fighting a relegation battle. We're not used to that. You know, we've had four promotions. We've had two winning trips to Wembley. We've been beaten three times in the last 5 years in the semi-final of the playoffs. Yet this year, we're fighting relegation. We don't know how to handle it, but we've got to stick together as a team. We've got to work harder. We've got to, you know, get out of the shit. Us, we're the only ones that can do it as a group, not individually. You can't do it individually. You need it as a team effort. And I'm confident we'll do that, please God.
I think with someone like yourself kind of at the forefront of that, I think absolutely that would be the case. But we're seeing this top down. You look at Manchester United at this moment in time, and you look at players that have left like that. Elanga, now over at Nottingham Forest. I think he got 3 assists at the weekend. Like, really shining. I hope I go and see Marcus Rashford doing the same at Aston Villa. And I really, truly believe that he will. Because Harry Maguire is another one. Like, you don't become a bad player overnight.
No, of course you don't. No. Yeah. No. But I'm a United supporter, and I've got to be honest, ever since Sir Alex left, the recruitment's been absolutely shit.
Yeah.
It's not Man United. They're not Man United players, in my opinion. Man United players are flowing, entertaining.
Yeah.
They're not entertaining anymore.
I agree to an extent, but Marcus Rashford was a fantastic player for that club. And I don't agree that it's just a bad attitude. You may know more than I.
No.
You know more, may know more than me.
It's totally wrong. Not last year, the year before, he got so many goals. You don't change overnight. Something's happened. None of us know what it is. But the previous two managers have not taken to him, have they?
No, and I'm sure that there's...
And your job as a manager is to get the best out of your players. And both those managers so far have failed miserably.
You say that's the mental side of it, isn't it? You say you were just talking there all about the tangible, the data, how far you're running. Obviously, you're all judged on that. But the biggest thing for me, the most important thing they should be tracking and should be trying to work on is the mentality. They should be working on players' minds. Like, how can you improve that? Because I think that then tenfolds the data. Like,
100%.
If you are willing to run through a brick wall for your manager, you're willing to run through a brick wall for your teammates, yourself. It doesn't, like, that data can say 12K on it. I guarantee if you're willing to do that, you'll surpass that. But you have to have that, I think, that confidence in you, that mindset needs to be drilled into them, needs to become a thing. Like, it's like we go in the gym, we work our bodies as hard as you can, let's build our bodies up. Why don't you do like the gym for the mind? Why don't you work on the mind?
So if you're going to run for a brick wall for someone, how do you have to feel for that person?
That you've seen.
I was going to say, you need to feel loved.
Yeah, you need to be seen.
If I'm going to run for a brick wall for you, I need to love you.
Yeah, of course.
I saw a really interesting kind of post-match talk. I don't know if either of you saw it with Scott Parker the other day, talking to his Burnley team. And it's this fantastic, I can't remember what game it's this. I think he speaks very, very well, Scott Parker. And he says to me, I can't thank any of you enough. Every single one of you would run through a brick wall for me.
And he said,
we've had Saturday, Tuesday for weeks and weeks and weeks. You're now off till Wednesday. The lads roar, right?
Brilliant.
And I was watching that and thinking, I'd love to play for you.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. I'd love to play for you. And that doesn't come from data or where he's been or where he's played. That comes from a feeling, from an emotion. We talked last week about your time at Wickham when you were underdogs and you kind of coming towards the end of your career and people thought, and you explained this changing room feeling you had under Gareth Ainsworth where you would just literally do anything.
It was. He was a miracle man, Gareth. He got the best out of his players, whatever.
Yeah. And that for me can't be measured.
No. And I think that puts you in a positive state. I think that puts you in a great mindset of being seen, being heard, feeling loved. We all feel loved.
Well, it's great when a manager loves you. It's the greatest feeling in the world.
But can we give that feeling to more people without them having to have gone and scored the winner on a Saturday? Can we give that to more people?
Looking back in my career as a manager, I was very honest, and if you was shit, I told you you was shit. But after the game, no matter what I'd bollocked you about, I was the first in the bar to buy you a drink. Yeah. And bear grudges, you know what I mean? And next week, you're the best player in the world because you've performed.
Yeah.
You know, and I'll let you know it.
Yeah.
You got to be very careful with players, how you react, because if I keep bollocking you, you'll be so frightened to keep getting them chances. I'm not going to run in that because he'll fucking moan if I lose, if I miss. You know what I mean? So there's two ways. You've got to point things out if he's doing wrong, but also you've got to encourage him to play what their assets are, and that's getting in the positions to score goals, whether they go in or not. Keep getting there, keep getting there, keep getting there. And so you've got to knock them down, but you've also got to pick them up. Because if you knock them down too much, they won't want the ball. They'll be frightened of you screaming and shouting on the bench at them. So you don't want the ball, because if you make a mistake or a bad pass or lose it, he's going to moan at you. You know what I mean? So it's a thin line. You've got to be told when you're not doing something and pull your finger out. As a manager, I want a reaction out of you. And if it's getting you by the throat to get a reaction out of you and you smashing me back, fine, I've got a reaction out of you. You know what I mean? That's the way I got away with murder, really. I think that's 5 minutes.
Yeah, I don't want to make it too fluffy, because of course football is very different to any other industry.
Yeah,
that you can get away with telling someone they're effing this, or you can get, and that is the game. But it's that ability, when it's all said and done, to look after them as a human being as well, and often like we drinking or not drinking, getting in the bar with someone afterwards and having a drink or having a moment where you can actually put your arm around them and just say.
Yeah.
It's all in the heat of it. It's important, but it's having them.
You just say, look, you set your own standards. You've fallen way below them today. Sorry I'd have got here, but I had to get a reaction. And after I give you a bollocking, you reacted well. Well done.
But that's the same.
So you got to knock them down and pick them up.
But this is not just football. This is life as well, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Like, no matter what walk of life you're in, yeah, that's true.
But relationships as well. I think one thing I would say I'm quite good at is being able to say sorry, being able to recognize when I was wrong in a situation. So Holly will laugh now, because sometimes she needs a bit of space to think about things, whereas I want to rectify anything straight away. Yeah, I'm not very good at giving any space. So I'm the first one to say, I made a mistake in that situation. And none of us are going to be perfect. None of us are. We're all going to make mistakes. But I think all we are in life is our reactions to them. And I think there's two types of people in this world. Someone falls over in front of you, you're either going to offer a hand to pick them up, or you're going to point a finger and laugh. And I'd like to be the people that
pick them up,
offer a hand and pick them
we
up.
We all need a hand of help now and then.
I think we are.
That's why you two are doing brilliant. Carry on the good work, chaps.
I hope so. Yeah. Should we ask Barry our new question? So. Craig and I have decided that any guest that comes on the pod is going to give the next guest their best bit of advice, perhaps that they were given, or they gave themselves, or they heard, or something that sat with them, that's really resonated with them, something they've carried with them. So
the best bit of advice after 4 years at Old Trafford in 1964-65 was Sir Matt Busby calling me in the office and saying, Barry, you've failed to reach your potential. So we've accepted an offer from Bolton for you to be there. I'm giving you a free transfer, and I want you to go there and prove me wrong. That's the best bit of advice I've ever had. And when I get rid of a player, I say that to him, whether it's a young academy player or whether it's a proper player, a full experienced player. I don't fancy you anymore, but go and prove me wrong. And I give a list of a lot of players that have been at pro clubs like me, went downhill, went to non-league and come back.
Beautiful.
Or went to the lower leagues and come back. internationals. Mm. You know, beautiful. Things like that. Unfortunately, I wasn't one of them.
But, yeah. But you made
it. But you know, I'm a great believer in one door shuts, another one opens.
Absolutely.
Take advantage of it.
Absolutely.
Best advice I ever had, and I'm still giving it now.
Thank you.
Cheers, Barry.
Thank you very much, Barry.
Keep the good work up, lads.
Thank you.
God bless you.
Thank you so much.